From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Vermont authors Amy Rose Capetta and Corey McCarthy, whose new novel is Once and Future, published by Little Brown. Corey McCarthy is the author of four young adult books, including Breaking Sky, which received multiple starred reviews and is in development to become a film by Sony Pictures, and a forthcoming nonfiction picture book. Corey is an Irish-Lebanese-American who, like many of their characters, is a member of the LGBTQ+ community. After earning a BA in creative writing from Ohio University, they completed UCLA's professional program in screenwriting and earned an MFA in writing for children and young adults from Vermont College of Fine Arts. Corey lives in the mountains of Vermont with their partner and young son. Amy Rose Capetta is the author of several YA novels, including Punk Rock Echo After Echo and The Brilliant Death. Amy Rose holds a BA in theater arts from UC Santa Cruz and an MFA in writing for children and young adults from Vermont College of Fine Arts. With Corey McCarthy, she is the co-founder of the Rainbow Boxes Initiative, which sent LGBTQIAP fiction to readers in all 50 states, and the Rainbow Writers Workshop, which helps find and develop exciting new voices. She lives in Vermont with her Once and Future co-author and the champion of her heart, Corey. Once and Future presents King Arthur as you've never imagined. This YA novel retells the popular legend with the Once and Future King as a teenage girl, and she has a universe to save. Ari Helix has a magic sword, a cranky wizard, and a revolution to start. When Ari crash lands on old Earth and pulls a magic sword from its ancient resting place, she's revealed to be the newest reincarnation of King Arthur. Then she meets Merlin, who has aged backward over the centuries into a teenager, and together they must break the curse that keeps Arthur coming back. Their quest? Defeat the cruel, oppressive government and bring peace and equality to all humankind. No pressure. When I spoke with Corey and Amy Rose last week, I asked them to begin by reading from the novel. Amy Rose read first a section about Ari, and then Corey read next a section featuring Merlin. And then I spoke with both of them. My voice sounds like I'm underwater in this interview because I had a little bit of sound trouble, but luckily the people that we really want to hear from sound fine. So I hope you enjoy our conversation.
There were things in this universe that Ari didn't understand. Space travel, for one. The segregation of Ketch, for another. Herself, for the grand finale. But this sword, it needed to be set free. She'd never felt anything so strongly in her whole life. Almost like someone was nudging her toward it. Almost as if that someone had been nudging for a lot longer than the last few minutes, and only now were they willing to tip their hand. She got her hands around the hilt and gave it a good tug. The sword budged. She tossed her long black hair behind her shoulder and set her stance wider, and pulled the sword. The blade came free with a ringing sound that didn't seem possible, and even though it had been lodged in that tree for however long, it was sharp and clean. And no doubt worth a lot of money. Their parents' savings were running lean these days. Selling this sword could solve several problems. "You're pretty enough to pay for a whole host of repairs to Kay's baby, not to mention all the snacks his heart desires." Ari swung it with a loose wrist. It had the perfect weight, like it was made for her. Already, she didn't want to trade it for tortilla chips, no matter how many it could buy. "Bad idea," she muttered, putting on her best Kay impression. "So now you've got a sword and an impulse control problem?" And now we're going to Merlin.
Okay. Merlin woke up. The ceiling of the crystal cave glimmered. He could make out, in a fuzzy way, points that stabbed the air high above his head. He reached for his glasses, smacking around on the cold floor until he found the thin wafers of glass, the horn rims. He settled them onto his face, and everything danced into focus. Merlin sighed. He didn't know why he bothered correcting his eyesight when there was no one to look at. At this point, he preferred his nightmares to being awake. Waking up meant caring about things like Morgana and magic. It meant the hamster wheel of tragedy was spinning, and it wouldn't stop until Arthur died again. What was our little bit.
Great. That's a great selection of sections to read. I loved these characters. I loved Merlin. I loved Ari and Kay and everybody.
Thank you.
So I want to ask you. What'd you say?
We had a lot of fun with our characters.
Yeah, they were really fun. So how did this book come to be? How did you decide to write this?
I like to tell people that I don't actually remember a time before wanting to see a girl King Arthur book, or a TV show or a movie. I love the fact that we get a new take on King Arthur every year almost from the media, and yet they're always the same. It's always the same guy that's cast, and I think the latest one that came out was 2 years ago now, yeah. Was the last straw, the Guy Ritchie one, where I was like, come on, you could have done something so different. So I had been waiting for this story for a long time, and Amy Rose and I, every couple of months, we sit down and we make a list of all the books that we want to write, and this helps us stay motivated. It's kind of a career thing, and at the end of every session, I would say, also, I want to write Girl King Arthur.
And I would say, you have to do that. Could you do it right now? Please, please, I need this book. So for a long time, I just wanted to read it. I didn't have any idea I would actually be part of writing the story. So that came later.
Yeah, so finally, I mean, to step into the King Arthur canon is very intimidating. And it's what held me back. I had so much respect for the story and all of the different authors' takes on it. I have read so many different King Arthur books that it was actually easier when I looked at Amy Rose and I was like, I will write it if you write it with me. And all of a sudden, this one chapter that I had that was from this girl King Arthur's point of view, I had been sitting on it for years. I had a chapter and it was the same thing I just read. It was Ari pulling the sword from a tree and becoming this King Arthur character. And then I handed that chapter to Amy Rose and she disappeared into the bedroom and was writing and came back with this Merlin character. I mean, I had told her that Merlin had aged backwards into a grumpy teen wizard, because if you know your King Arthur canon, Merlin ages backwards. And that's how far into the future we are. And Amy Rose came back with this hysterical, sensitive, beautiful, metaphor-driven creature that is Merlin. And all of a sudden, the book was real to me in a way that it never had been before. The roadblock was gone. All of a sudden, I could see this story because we were both writing it. And
that's great. That's really fun. So when you would sit down and make a list of projects you wanted to work on, those weren't collaborative projects. You were just sitting down together to be support for one another as far as your upcoming work.
Yes.
Yes, okay. We take turns. Amy Rose will sit there and write down everything I say. And sometimes the stories are full-formed, and it's like, I want to write this book, and I have an elevator pitch. And sometimes I'm like, I want to write Girl King Arthur, and that's it, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And you know, we both love retelling so much. We actually, this is the second book that we started to write together.
It is.
We haven't told anyone else that. You're getting new information from us.
This is the secret stuff. Yeah.
We were working on a retelling of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh, wow.
And it was really fun, but we weren't making it work. Well, we may come back to it at some point.
I'm a big Shakespeare nerd from way back. I used to be in a Shakespeare troupe and all these things. And so we were looking at Midsummer and we were having a lot of fun with it, but we weren't changing enough. And yeah. I think part of that is I was so close to that play, and I'm a big fan of King Arthur. I've read so many different incarnations of it, but I could see ways to change it that were exciting. So it didn't feel like there's that step away from the source material where you're both borrowing so much of what you love from it, but you're also looking at it from a bit of a critical distance that adds something new.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be a real benefit to a collaboration, particularly if one person is closer to the original material than the other, like you just said. You mm-hmm. know, that strikes that. I hadn't thought about that, but that, yeah. I did have questions about your collaboration. So who did what, and how did you decide who was taking what on?
So it's very interesting. There's a two-step process with this book and with its sequel, which we are currently working on, which is called The Sword in the Stars. The first draft, I write Ari's point of view chapters, and Amy Rose writes Merlin's. We talk through every chapter before we write it. We also end up changing things while we're writing it, which is pretty natural. After the first draft process, we move into a very different sort of collaboration where one of us will be working on large sections of the book at a time. So I will sit down with 100 pages and I will make as many edits as I want in both of our chapters. And we do not use track changes.
Yep.
Which is scary to some writers. They start to, like, so I will change things and she won't necessarily know that I changed them.
It's so
unless she disagrees.
Yeah. Unless there's one little sentence that lodges in your brain. You're like, I needed that sentence. But then you have to, but then you have to explain why you needed it and make it better and sort of find the way to keep it if it's really, really worth it. But honestly, 90% of the time, the cuts just fall away and the story gets stronger and stronger and it becomes more and more of a true collaboration where it's not just one person throwing in one idea and one person throwing in another, but you get to the point where everything, the whole book belongs to both of us and it becomes its own creature too, because it's very different from our other books. It has its own voice.
Yeah, that's very courageous. That's a very courageous way to move forward. You had copies of it though, right?
We save each draft, yeah. And so every time we start to work on it.
If we really needed to go back to something, we probably could dig it up, but we try to just keep going forward and trusting that it's evolving in the way that it needs to. We both really, really like large scale revision and just throwing out whole chunks of story. Yeah. It's weirdly satisfying to just say, oh, now that I can see what I need, that can all just fall away. That old piece can just fall away.
Now, have you both always been writers?
Yes. We have a similar story that we were both child writers who then grew up, went to college for writing. Neither one of us ever had another dream.
Or another career planned out at all.
I did burn through a lot of different formats before I hit writing for children and young adults. I started in poetry and short story and memoir writing, and then I went into screenwriting and I got a degree in that. And then I finally ended up at Vermont College of Fine Arts, where they have an MFA program in writing for children and young adults. And that is where I met Amy Rose.
Yes. And I had a background in dramatic writing as well. I did a lot of playwriting. I was a theater arts major in college. So lots of playwriting, some screenwriting, and lots of different things before I, you know, came back around to what I had originally loved as a kid and been writing. Just for myself, which were fantasy and sci-fi novels and these big genre epics that I loved to read and that I loved as a fan, first and foremost. And I think it's funny that people always say, you know, don't quit your day job.
When they
I had a day job, but they always assume your day job is something that's worth not quitting. I was like, I'm making coffee. I'm gonna quit this one.
Yeah. And now... Now we have really worked hard to support ourselves on our writing at this point. That, however, means that we have cobbled together. You know, I'm also a teacher at Vermont College of Fine Arts now, and
congratulations! That's wonderful.
Thank you.
I've always wanted to go back and do that. I graduated from the program in just adult fiction.
Awesome. It's VCFA magic, right?
Love that school.
So I teach there, and that is quarter time work, and then we are also freelance editors. If you look at our CV, we publish a lot of books because we kind of reach our hands into different age groups and genres to kind of, you know, to put it all together to make it possible, because, you know, writing one book every 3 years is not really a living. I mean, for some people it is.
Oh, yeah. not for us quite
not
yet.
Not for us yet.
But, you know, we just do what we can to make it sustainable.
This book does this book launch tomorrow?
It comes out on Tuesday, so Tuesday the 26th. Yeah.
Okay. So this book isn't out yet, so you don't know what this book holds, but this looks like it could be a big book. Like, I don't mean to say that.
Thank you. Well, we'll knock on wood here.
I know, let's all knock on wood.
Yeah.
I don't know, just reading the Goodreads gear up people are super excited about this book. So
we have seen a level of
support
and excitement that has been really wonderful and heartening. So we're excited to see what happens next now that it's actually going out into the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to talk about the book too. Let's see. A lot of the reviews seem to focus on the gender aspect of the book, which I want to talk about in a minute. But there are so many themes in Ones and Future. And I wondered if... So I'll just mention there's immigration, adoption, corporate greed,
aging, reparation for past mistakes.
There's a lot. And there's a lot that just exists kind of organically in the Arthur tale, mm-hmm. and that I'm sure was fun to work with. So I wonder if you ever felt overwhelmed by all that you had taken on. There's a lot going on.
It helped that there were two of us. I don't know. It might have been too much for just one like mental load to sort of carry all of that and hold all of it in our heads at once. But it really was good to have both of us, and then at some point our editor, who's amazing, stepped in and also helped us sort of keep all of the pieces in the air as we went.
I was going to say there were actually three of us because we've done a lot of books, and some of the books that we've written, you know, we worked with an editor who did some light notes, but basically what was acquired, what went out. What was acquired with Once and Future is not the book that is actually coming out. Our editor put us through very, very large note rounds, and we were so delighted by it. I think that in another circumstance, in another world, this book wouldn't have been as strong or as complicated, but our editor, who is Aubrey Poole, who is fantastic. If you are a writer, you want to work with her. You do. It was just really exciting that she wasn't going to let anything be good, like, fine. It had to be better, you know? Yeah. And
if there
really
was a theme that was halfway there, if there was a theme that was like halfway in the book, she had that eagle eye of saying, okay, I see something emerging, but we have to make it a big deal or it shouldn't be in the book. And so we had to make everything sort of carry its weight.
And to answer your question, we are now working on the sequel and it is too complicated. It is burning a hole through both of our brains.
It's officially too many things.
Yes.
But this one, I think we're finding a way to simplify down to what the story really needs to be.
Yes.
Yeah, because there are so many pieces.
And that's been hard because there are so many characters and we love all of these characters. But when you have a story like this, which is an adventure thriller, the pace has to take precedence over, you know, those wonderful character scenes. But we still want them in there. So finding that balance was very tricky.
Yeah, the first draft, the one that we send before we even sent it out, the first one that we wrote was maybe 90% banter. It was just our characters on a spaceship,
having
making
fun.
Jokes about swords.
Yeah, kissing.
You mean you talking about the sequel now?
Oh no, the first version of Once and Future was just a character fest. It was all fun. There were the bad guy existed, but like just in the background. You know, every once in a while he'd like poke the characters and something bad would happen. And then we would just go back to banter.
And our agents who read to the first version that we sent to our agents, they read it really fast. We have wonderful, wonderful agents. And they got back to us like a week later and they were like, "This is great. We'd love this. It needs to be 40,000 words shorter." We're like, okay, so we'll just take a third of the book out. Okay.
Our agents are great and they agree on everything, which is funny because we were like, well, what's going to happen when we get two different sets of notes from them? And they just always talk to each other beforehand and they agree on everything. So they come back to us as this united front and say, cut 40,000 words, but everything else is great.
So that was
I think it's fun that your agents are also a collaboration. That's interesting.
They are,
They are a united front, and they're both named Sarah, so we have the Sarahs that,
I think I saw that in your acknowledgments. That's funny.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. So the book is diverse and gender bending. One of your blurbs called it the holy grail of inclusiveness, which I loved. I thought that was a great blurb. And I also really enjoyed that the round table works so well as a device for equality. You know, that's very early in the book. I think Kay says to Ari, "No single person at the head and an equal voice for all." So that was a nice moment. I just wonder if you want to talk a little bit about making the book diverse and that decision and it's very diverse. So
yeah, I mean, I think to us in a lot of ways it didn't feel like a decision we had to make because of what the story is, because we're telling this, we're reimagining the King Arthur story for the future, and so you get the equality of the Round Table, but also the original Round Table had some hypocrisy built in because it
Absolutely.
Was just men sitting there and yeah. of certain sort of identities you would be the same thing over and over. So
right.
you just immediately say, okay, if you had a new Round Table, you need a lot of actual inclusivity in that group to make it yeah. feel like it's more like it's starting to really fulfill that promise of equality.
We definitely modeled the Knights of the Rainbow after our friend group.
Yeah.
And in particular, the friend groups that we meet when we do school visits at high schools. And these packs of queer teenagers come up to us, and they're all different, and they all have different identities, and they are all friends. And it was sad to us that books like this didn't really exist. I mean, they're starting to exist now. Marcus Shiro's Anger is a Gift has a very diverse queer friend unit. But these are things that exist in the real world on a regular basis, and yet not in YA fiction. Something else that's been coming up when we've been having conversations with people is, like, they see all of the knights as being all these diverse characters, and that makes sense and is exciting to them. And then they're like, but why does Kay have two moms? Like, why did you go all that far?
But, like, that's the step too far, which is funny because those are the characters. People ask us who we are in the book. And if we're being really
yeah.
100% honest, even though there are pieces of us in each character,
yeah.
we're the moms.
We're the moms. So we actually wrote our family unit into yeah. the story. And that's the one thing that people are like, did you just put that in there? I'm like, no, we just wrote ourselves.
we wrote ourselves as space captains.
I'm Captain Mom. This is Mom.
Yeah, yes. yeah but you wrote yourself as incarcerated space captains.
Oh, so true. It's all right. We bust out. Oh, spoiler.
Okay, so let's see. I loved Merlin's accidentally using the wrong pronoun early in the book and having to apologize and explaining about coming from a time of gender assumptions. And I feel like this book sort of educates people about gender assumptions and how not to follow that path. I don't know if I have a question about that. I just liked it, so I'll just mention that.
Thank you very much. I think the amount of people that have reacted to that 4 or 5 sentence part in the book, really early in the book, has been really exciting to both of us, because I don't think we put a lot of, we didn't think we were doing anything major by putting that in there. To us, it was just like, here's a fantastic way to show that Merlin comes from this one place, but the future is this different place.
Yes.
And they have finally gotten over the hurdle of assuming people's genders based on what they look like. And so it's been really exciting to see so many different people repost that one section.
Yeah. I think my other favorite Merlin moment is later in the book, and Merlin is this sort of kind of awkward teenager in this version of the tale, and he's about to be kissed, and he, like, gets anxious, and all this magic starts falling off of his fingers, and it comes off. His, like, colors are yeah. flashing. It was really fun.
That just feels like a magical extension of what happens in real life when you're having yeah. those feelings.
When you're a teenager and you're so excited.
That's great. I remember that feeling of just, like, shaking.
So, Merlin ages backward, mm-hmm. losing years with each cycle. And then the cycle is find Arthur, train Arthur, nudge Arthur onto the nearest throne, defeat the greatest evil in the world, and unite all of mankind. Now, was that, I'm sorry, I'm not more familiar with these, all the various versions of these books. Was that you coming up with a bullet list of what actually does usually happen in these books and kind of creating it as a repeating cycle, basically?
Yeah, definitely. That was, so you'll notice that in our retelling, we have taken bits and pieces of different King Arthur canon that we like. We've taken some things that we don't like and we have pointed out that they're problematic. When it came to those, that particular state, so that was, that's a moment of stated intention, which is a writer's tricky way of telling the reader exactly what they think is going to happen or putting them on a track. And right. Merlin is such a track-oriented right. individual. And also because a large part of Merlin's arc is that Merlin can't see beyond the cycle.
Yeah.
He can't attach to people. He is just going through the motions and these are the motions. And so right. by the end of the story, he's gotten right. to a place where he's ready to break his own cycle because he loves his friends and because he wants them to succeed and not just the story, the King Arthur story to succeed.
Yeah, and I think there's also that feeling of he's trying to simplify it down to the hero's, you know, a hero's story, essentially. You know, everything will be fine as long as the hero does these five things. But of course, it's never going to be that simple in real life. It's going to get a lot messier than that. So we start off with that expectation that as long as a hero rises and does the necessary things, all will be well. You know, Merlin's still going on that narrative after thousands of years of seeing that maybe that's not quite enough to actually solve all of humankind's problems. So so we're, you know, we're starting him out in that place where he's still learning so much. And I like what you brought up earlier, which is that Merlin really is our way of bringing the problems of the past and putting them into a new context, or the problems of even our current moment, which will then, you know, in the story is the past, and bringing them into a new context. So we have once in future, in a lot of ways, is the description of, you know, we've got Merlin, who's the past, and Ari, who's the future, and bringing them together and seeing what happens, and how much Merlin has to really rise to these new challenges and yes. figure things out in a way that he's never been asked to before.
Yeah. Right, and the he's been through the cycle so many times that he doesn't see the potential for it to change. And I loved that fill in a past that we might not be familiar with as readers. I'm sure some of it's not in the canon and some of it is, but for example, this is from the book, "What if this Arthur finally united mankind and brought the cycle to a close, ending the story as triumphantly as Arthur 12 killed the giant with three eyes, or Arthur 40 had stopped the cyborg uprising?" And I thought that was a fun way to just kind of like fill in history and let us sort of envision it in our own way without like really writing all of these pasts.
Yeah, we had like a master list of all the Arthurs and where they were and what they did, and it would have been so much fun to be able to include more. But at the end of the day, you just gotta sort of let people have a little tempting bits, and then you gotta keep going with the story you're telling. So yeah. just for our own purposes, we did yeah. get to imagine all of the Arthurs, though, and that was a really fun exercise.
And there
could be a series of graphic novels someday.
Ooh, yeah,
there is a contemporary Arthur 37 is contemporary,
Arthur
37, right?
Yeah.
And that I'm not gonna lie, Arthur 37 is probably our favorite, and we won't get into it because he comes up in memory in the sequel a few times. And I just want to say he's a rock star. So, and he's a real person. We haven't gotten this person's permission yet to use we might have to dance around
in our minds. He's a very specific
rock star. He's a very specific rock star. And if you look at our yeah. acknowledgments, you will figure out who we might have been inspired by. Yes.
Okay. I'm going to have to reread them now. You mean from this book?
Yep. It's in the acknowledgments in that one. Yep.
Okay. Let's see. I loved this sentiment. It's a quote from the book. "Humans had to leave behind the certainty that they understood the universe now that they had to face more than a tiny slice of it." And the universe that's being talked about in that moment is actually physically the universe, but it's not just physical, it's cultural. And I loved that embraced so much more than just the moment in the narrative. I'm sure you had this in mind as you wrote that and many other things.
Yes, definitely. It was both exciting and painful to imagine a humanity that existed in spread over galaxies, several galaxies. I think we came up to about three.
Yeah, three galaxies.
We're not going to be gluttonous with our universe here. But yeah, it's to think about how humans in a firefly kind of way have spread out and what they would need to actually exist. And that is where Mercer came in, who is the antagonist. And Mercer is a very, very, very large corporation who controls everything from water supplies to government. And that, of course, is an extension of contemporary situations. And then the flip side of that was to have Earth be abandoned, which we didn't think we would be sad about until we brought the characters back there. And we had, it came out in revision where we were painting this picture of destroyed Earth, and it was very sad. Yeah. Very, very yeah. sad. Yeah. Very sad and very realistic. Like, you can't even...
Not the idea right. of, it's, it, yeah, leaving behind everything you know, but also having those, you know, bridges to everything you knew behind you be burning. It's, yeah. It's more, yeah, it's more than just having to, like, peacefully leave. It's this sense that everything behind you is sort of, has been ruined in your wake. And that's something that I think was hard to face, but necessary if we wanted to tell this kind of future story.
The saddest moment in the book that I wrote, and there are a lot of sad moments, but the saddest one was early on when it was Morgana talks about the people who were left behind, when the people who could leave Earth left, and what happened to the people who were left behind. And I remember writing that, and I remember sliding the computer reading heroes and being like, I'm sorry, you're gonna have to read this now.
That was rough. I remember that day.
Yeah.
you mentioned
yeah, I remember Oh, no, just to that point, do you know the author Thomas Harris, who wrote Silence of the Lambs? I think his name is Thomas Harris. I remember reading a quote from him about just sort of what we have to acknowledge about ourselves when we create these horrible moments. You know, mm-hmm. what we have to sort of acknowledge exists in our creative minds when we have to create horrible scenarios. And I think he gave us permission, and it made me feel better. But
it's a way to talk about your darkness. I'm on the edge of hopefully one day publishing a story that is very post-apocalyptic in nature, and I realize that this is something that lives inside of me in a very real way. And I could try not to write about it, but actually writing about it makes me feel better.
And
you know, in our writing and as in our teaching, we're always asking writers and readers to find the thing that scares them, the thing that they're trying not to think about, and draw it out into the light so that it can't punish them. So that was definitely part of it when it came to Once in Future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And do they ever say, I'm afraid of the fact that my collaborator will edit my work without track changes?
The darkest fear of them all. I don't think they'd ever allow that. I mean, there are people like... in the gasp in pain when we say that. And I'm like, you know, it's actually more painful to have the track changes than to be able to see, like, well, why'd she take that word out?
Right.
That
right.
was a good, that no, word was
when
fine.
You don't, yeah, when you don't know about it, your brain just keeps moving. And I think it's an interesting comment on the way people see authors, I think, because a lot of people see authors as working very much in isolation. You know, you work with your own words, the idea that just all of it's coming from you, and we both come from backgrounds of dramatic writing, which is much more collaborative in nature. And so I think it feels very natural to me, I know, to get a lot of feedback, to have a lot of voices involved, and it doesn't ever make me go like want to clamp down and be like, no, I have to protect every sentence. It's like, no, tell me what's going to make this better, you know?
Right.
I want that sense. That
yeah,
it's gonna.
The more willing you are to be collaborative, the more of a chance you'll be published.
Because
publishing asks for things, and then you have to decide whether or not you're willing to do that.
Because in the end, the idea of the isolated author is kind of a myth that we've all built up. Because even if you don't have a co-writer, even if you don't have, you know, someone actually writing the story with you, your editor should be your collaborator. A lot of people,
and your agent and the market
and the people who give you early reads and give you feedback. Mm-hmm. Like they're all people who are part of it.
It's all a moving cycle. I mean, I do write books that are completely outside of that I've just written for myself. And I love doing it, but I'm not sure I'll publish them. I'm not even sure I'll try to publish them because they're stories that I wrote for me.
Uh-huh. Now, just to the point of collaboration and editors and agents, do you have writing support outside of those things? Do you belong to a writing group, or do you mostly just kind of talk about writing with each other and your agents and editors?
Well, we're very lucky and spoiled in the fact that we have each other, because we get to read each other's early pages. We edit each other's work. By the time we were collaborating, we were already editing each other's work pretty intensely. Yeah. So we have a lot of what you might get from a writing group, we get to have just in our day-to-day relationship, which is really lovely. And it's this constant creative collaboration. But I did have a writing group previous to that. Back when I lived in Texas, I had a great writing group. And our MFA program has given us so much community and so many people that we've, you know, traded early reads on things. But I think now we're at the point where usually things are on deadline and we have to write them and just trust that we can send them straight to our agent or our editor, with only having each other possibly having seen some of the earlier work.
Yeah, uh-huh. And I'll just piggyback on your mention of our MFA program. I think a lot of times people ask about, like, do you need an MFA to get published or write? And it's like, that's not a yes or no question.
Right.
But one of the things that you should be hoping to get from your MFA program is a sense of community and supportiveness. I have 3 degrees in writing, and 2 of those degrees are from colleges where the writers were pinned against each other. And it was not supportive, and it was the last man standing every time. And so when I came to Vermont College of Fine Arts, I had, like, my boxing gloves ready, and I was like, all right, let's do this. And everyone was like, let's talk about what we think your strengths are as a writer. And I was like, what's happening? Like, they're like, we're going to all build each other up and help each other. And I was like, this is what this money is for. So yeah. I actually, although I got a lot of writing skill, very tangible writing skills from getting my master's, the thing that I came away from was the ability to show other people my writing, to take their feedback, and to make writing into a career. I was not equipped to do that before this.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago that you're a couple. I don't think we've actually said that during the interview. So I wondered how that affected the writing of the book, that you are also a couple. And also, how did the writing of the book affect your home life, if that's not too personal?
definitely not too personal. We actually kind of assume that people know that we're together, but they don't.
We have to tell them.
Sometimes. We have to tell them. So we've been together for a number of years, and we have been writing together since we met each other, 9 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And did it affect us at all? I mean, like, the writing of Once in Future, particularly the first draft, was not something we did on purpose, which is a funny thing to say. We were both writing our other books during the day, our peak writing time in the morning. And then Once in Future would happen at night when I was cooking dinner. Amy Rose would go and write a chapter one night, and then we would switch that the next night. And we were having so much fun. This is how we overwrote by 40,000 words, by the way.
Yeah.
We were having so much fun that we just kept doing it. We kept swapping. We kept building the story and building the story.
Yeah.
And it was really a couples bonding thing, actually, in the end, because, you know, we really fell in love. We fell in love with the girls. There are some similarities to Ari and Gwen's relationship that are very much set in our relationship. I particularly love it when I write something and Amy will look at me and she'll be like, Gwen would not say that.
and occasionally you're like, no, Gwen would say that. You just wouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Oh, fine. but usually I have the Gwen stuff sort of locked down and you're a lot more Ari. But
I will say the one part of this book that is important that comes from us being a couple is that we wrote this, we started writing this book directly after the election, the results of the election. We were living in rural Midwest, and we were facing death threats from our community who decided that we shouldn't exist amongst them. So we started writing this book. We weren't leaving the house because if you live in the Midwest, everyone has a handgun, and it's very scary when they tell you they want to kill you. And so we we're writing this book out of hope, and it was what made us happy.
Yeah. It was coming from a shared emotional response more than anything that we've ever, you know.
It was giving us joy in a time of real darkness, and then in the process we were abandoning ship. We were, gathering all of our savings, packing up, giving away everything, our stuff to move. So we moved to Vermont. So our community in the Midwest got their wish. We left them. But, this book is a very huge part of us as a couple, because it was, we have to go somewhere else. We have a small child, he has to be safe. We have to send him to a school where we know people aren't going to be horrible to him, because of our family unit is different from other people's idea of what a family should be. So this book really came through that. I think a lot of people are surprised by the level of identity freedom that we wrote into it, but it was because we needed it.
Just being able to imagine a future where, your gender is what it is and your sexuality is what it is, and there's no normative expectations in any particular direction was really, really helpful to us at that time. And we're hoping we can, share that with other people who might need to see that right now.
Mm-hmm.
Just getting to carve out our own hopeful space in the middle of all of that was absolutely necessary.
Yeah, it's interesting hearing your story. I don't mean to trivialize your story at all, but I feel like it's almost a metaphor for a larger thing that's happening, which is that the reaction to the election is creating a lot of pushback and creative work and change, right? And so it sometimes doesn't feel like it's creating change, but I think it is.
I hope so. I mean, when we were in that really tough period, we weren't leaving the house. We were having our groceries delivered by Amazon, which is really funny if you read Once in Future. The only time we were leaving was to go to our teen writing group, which was at this, very, very, very rural school. And we had this band of like 20 kids who all happened to be either allies or queer individuals, because they looked at us.
They saw us.
And we were like the Pied Pipers. They watched us come through the hallway and they just came after us. We were teaching them how to write stories to help them. They were very mad and upset. And we were working on this story in front of them to kind of pattern how you can put your feelings and your hopes out there and hope that they turn into something real. So they are actually who we dedicated this book to. This book wouldn't exist without them.
It's part of a very big thing that's happening. Our story is not happening in isolation at all.
Thank goodness, right?
Yeah.
Let's see. I have a few more questions. I want to talk about villains. The book has old villains and the book has new villains. And so I wonder if you could talk about the depiction of Morgana versus the depiction of the evil monopolizing corporation called Mercer, which you, invented.
I love writing Morgana.
I'm going to let Amy Rose talk about Morgana.
Talk about Morgana all day if someone would let me. The opportunity to write an ancient enchantress who has been, embroiled in this magical cycle forever and is sort of pitted as a nemesis against Merlin, but also has so much in common with him at the same time. They're the only two who've been here and seen the whole thing. And lived as long as they have. And well, Morgana's not technically alive, but she's very much present. And there was something really wonderful about getting to write a character who, to me, was an antagonist, but not a villain. I never saw her as evil. I never saw her as the bad guy. I saw her as someone whose version of the truth and of the story was diametrically opposed to the character that I was writing, except I could see the story from both sides. So to get to sort of play that and then also write magic battles at the same time was absolutely delightful. And she was actually the character who evolved the most from where we started with her and what we sort of knew about her to where she ended at the end of the book. She had this really organic sort of growth and change.
She started to become funny
She was funny. It was
a surprise, but it was very exciting because it meant that we and Ari and the characters in the book had sort of uncovered her humanity.
That link between humor and humanity is something I think we're always exploring in these books, and just how you use it in really dark times, how you use it as a defense mechanism, how you use it to bond with other people despite the world sometimes rejecting you in other ways. I feel like that humor is something we're always looking for, and when we find it, when the joke, we always say that when the jokes start to arrive in the scene, we know we're doing the right thing with the story.
When the characters start facing things that are kind of terrible and impossible, and they're all of a sudden they're making jokes about it, we're like, no, that's what we would do. So, you know, this is their reaction. Mercer, so the evil corporation Mercer, which I do like to explain to people, is as if several of the more well-known corporations in our contemporary world all swallowed each other, and the fish got bigger and bigger and bigger. So you got Disney in there, and Google, and Amazon, and all the, you know, and you just keep going. Say if one came to the top of the pile of all of those things, that would be what Mercer is. And Mercer, that was not there in the beginning of the first draft. They existed, but they were more of a comical bad guy. And through our editing with our, through the revision with our editor, Aubrey, she kept saying, you're half pointing to contemporary problems. You should full point. And we were like, no, we don't want to do it. It's terrible. We don't want to. And she was like, you have to. And we're so glad that she kind of held our arm behind our back and made us do it. Because we were talking about things that they're terrifying. It's terrifying to believe that the thing that is making your life possible is also ruining your life and harming people. And to bring that to light for a young adult audience, I think was a really hard choice for us to make, because we're basically saying all of the privilege that you have is causing other people pain. Remember that, you know? And so that, and then the, I don't know if we'll get into the administrator here. The administrator was terrifying because every time we talked earlier about how you write something and then you feel like it tells you something about yourself. I write the administrator. I write every line that comes out of his mouth. And
oh, you owned it.
And I do it very, very quickly and succinctly. Like, I didn't stress about any of those lines. They just fell out. And I'm ashamed, and I don't know where it came from. but he's terrifying. He's terrifying because he thinks he's right, and he doesn't think that he could any situation he can manipulate, and it's a game.
Yeah.
I think those are the scariest people out there, the people who are delighted by your resistance.
We're delighted by, you know, seeing that they can sort of manipulate certain situations, and they're so insulated from consequence that it doesn't matter to them.
It reminds me a little bit when, like, Star Wars was so huge, and then Disney's like, it's okay, we'll just own you soon. And they did, you know? And I feel like the administrator is very much like that. He's like, oh, do you have a rebellion? It's okay, we'll co-opt that. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the scariest thing, because we see that happening so often.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
In publishing. I mean, I hate to say it, but, like, I don't even know which publishers still exist and which ones have been swallowed by other ones.
Right. Yeah.
Let's see. We're winding down on the clock. I want to ask you a couple more things. I'm wondering if either or both of you can talk about some books that you've read lately that you've particularly enjoyed and might recommend to listeners who are readers, which I think most of the listeners are readers.
I just watched Amy Rose finish the fourth book in a series that she's been reading for the last 5 years last night. And she was in mourning that it was over, and so blissful and so happy. So I would like her to tell everyone about this series.
Okay, it's the Charlotte Holmes series. First book is A Study in Charlotte, and it is a retelling. So we're talking about reimaginings, right? So this is a contemporary reimagining with the Sherlock Holmes stories, and they've been reinvented at beginning at a boarding school in New England and then sort of going on from there. And there's something about the way that the writer Brittany Cavallaro reinterprets all of the pieces of Sherlock that you love, but also brings new things into the story that I feel like was that was a reimagining that I was definitely keeping in mind as we were starting to work on something like this. Just the ability to preserve the pieces and then comment on them sometimes, sort of twist them around, present them from a new angle. Like there's clearly so much love and respect for the original story, while at the same time, it really gives it a whole new life. And the two main characters are just they're so dear to me. Okay. So if you're looking for a good series that is a YA reimagining of a much loved classic, I can't recommend that one highly enough.
And I get to read it next.
The author is
Brittany Cavallaro.
Oh, Brittany Cavallaro. Sorry, I misunderstood you. Okay.
And since we're talking about retellings, I will throw out my favorite author that I have discovered who has done a couple classic retellings, which is Lily Anderson. And her first book was The Only Thing Worse Than Me Is You. And that is a retelling of Much Ado About Nothing. And it is about teenagers in a highly competitive, high-achieving high school who are all ranked. And so your Benedict and your Beatrice are these two who are going head-to-head on an academic. And it's hilarious. It has a very good ensemble cast, and it also, one of the things we've been talking about this whole past hour is just like updating things, pointing out problematic material. Like, I love the way she fixed Hero's story in her retelling so that it is not terrible slut-shaming. It's not like she doesn't die of being slut-shamed, or being framed, you know? So that's the one thing that we can do for a young adult audience. We can bring attention to these older classical stories and fix them a little bit.
We can say you can love and appreciate this and still acknowledge what about it is not okay.
Yeah. So, you know.
Great.
Yeah. So, and then her second book is a retelling of The Importance of Being Earnest. And that is cool. Called Not Now, Not Ever. So yes, definitely check out Lily Anderson. Yes.
Okay, awesome. My main last question for our interview is if you have any advice about world building in fantasy and science fiction. And I know it's a huge question, but we really haven't talked about that aspect of your book, and I think it's fantastic. I just, part of what drew me in right from the start was the ship and the technology, and I was just like, wow, how are they coming up with this? Anyway, can you talk a little bit about advice for writers who are working on world building in fantasy and science fiction?
I will talk about my favorite point of advice on world building. I usually draw a picture, so I'm going to describe it for people. If you draw a circle, and the circle is the world of your story, right? You want to create all kinds of things. You want to fill that circle with information on different cultures, the geography, the food, the religion, whatever it is, you have to fill it all in. But when you sit down to write the story, you're going to draw a train track straight through that circle. And you're going to have to realize that some of those things you came up with don't belong in the story. So the story must stay on the train tracks, and the only thing the reader can experience are what they're seeing out the window. And I think when I work with a lot of freelance fantasy and sci-fi editors, or writers, as an editor, and the one thing I'll say is I'll highlight three pages and I'll be like, this is beautiful, awesome world building. It is in the middle of your scene. Take it out. You know, you have to find a way to make it a part of the story, or you have to lose it. And that is painful, but know that it's for you. And if you become J.K. Rowling, then you get to write books about all that stuff that was not in the original one.
Yeah. All right.
And then mine would be, so I think when a lot of people think about world building, you can go and you can find like lots of lists of questions, you know, things that you want to know about your world, things you want to think about, you know, what is, like you were saying, what's this part of your world? What's that part of your world? All the different aspects of it. And those can be really helpful, but remember that whatever you're creating, it always has to come back to the fact that this world is populated by the humans who live in it. You can't, anything you come up with has to make sense in terms of, you have to think about it at the human scale as much as you have to think about it at the big scale. Would humans really believably, you know, how would they interact? So the landscape is important, but how do they interact with the landscape? You know, these you can make a list of religions or magic systems, but you have to also be able to come back to, okay, but how does your character actually feel about this magic? You know, how did people in the past use it, or what is the history behind it that comes from, you know, actual human motivations that are believable? And when it comes right down to it, there's no escaping that no matter what your world is, it was created by people, unless you're talking about aliens. And that gets more interesting, but then you still have to come up with the system of how they view everything and then how they interact with everything. And I really loved this quote recently from, I don't want to say the quote wrong, but Nnedi Okorafor, who had said that she was sometimes, that she was upset that people always thought that her aliens were a metaphor for humans. And she's like, it would just write about humans. The aliens are so much more interesting. Just like the aliens in her story are meant to be different. And that's, they're meant to be their own, you know, they really are meant to be their own species. And that's kind of the point. So I thought that was great too. So yeah, you can be writing about things other than humans, but then you have to have, but then you have to know all of that. And you have to take into account how they interact with everything and how they see the universe and how, you know, and how that affects the world. So I think that just make sure that you're looking at it on the human scale, on the one individual scale, as much as on the big epic scale that is sometimes very fun to think about, but can take you away from a realistic and believable emotional kind of story.
That's great. Wonderful. So I want to mention again, the name of the book is Once in Future, this time Excalibur Chooses Her, by Amy Rose Capetta and Corey
McCarthy.
And it's published by Jimmy Patterson Books at Little Brown. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I love the book and it's really fun to talk to you about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've had a blast.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Corey McCarthy and Amy Rose Capetta, co-authors of Once in Future, published by Little Brown, presented by James Patterson. You can learn more at amyrosecapetta.com and corymccarthy.com. And I have to apologize to Corey at the end of our conversation when we were actually recording that I missaid McCarthy. And then you probably just now noticed my God voice coming in and correcting it for you. But anyway, corymccarthy.com is their website. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guests this week, Corey McCarthy and Amy Rose Capetta. When they received notes from their editor about a slow section of Once and Future that for one reason or another needed a little work, perhaps not enough was happening for a few pages, they would sit down and brainstorm what they came to call the 10 worst things that could happen to your character. The first thing was always that the character dies. Even if this is not the answer, Corey and Amy Rose say that you have to include ridiculous things as well as possibilities. The ridiculous things loosen up the other things that might actually lead to a solution. So, good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Speaking of next week, I just want to mention that 1 week from today is April 1st, and that is the day that Write the Book starts to broadcast at 4 p.m. and is only going to be 1 hour long. That generally means that I will be playing new interviews as the format has been while the station was building itself up. I had one new interview every week, and then in a second hour I had usually a rerun, not always, but usually. We have so many new hosts coming in with great shows. It's really exciting. And so the schedule's changing a little bit, and Write the Book is going to go to 1 hour from 4 to 5 every Monday, usually with a new interview. So that's exciting, and it starts next Monday. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, you can send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell your friends. We want to get the word out about Write the Book so that we get lots of people listening and writing more. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.